Welcome to the Duluth Rundown interview portion. We're about to get started with our interview here with Dr. David Worley, but first, a quick advertisement for our sponsor of this episode, Austin Jaro. Austin Jaro is Duluth's original running store. And go there for everything that you need, from running shoes, running socks, running clothes, food, everything that you need for running, but most importantly, running expertise. You can visit Austin Jaro and utilize their staff for some key knowledge. Any questions that you may have, especially as the weather turns a little bit colder, for cold weather clothing or winter trail running shoes, things of that nature. So Austin Jaro is in the mall area of Duluth, 917 West Central Entrance, Duluth, Minnesota, 55811. You can reach them by phone, 218-722-1185, or online, austin-jaro.com. Now on to our interview.
Okay, and we are back and joined on the interview section of the podcast. We're joined with Dr. David Worley. David, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Today we're going to talk a lot of some of the medical stuff and some of the current COVID concerns, specifically for runners and, you know, what they want to be looking out for. Obviously, you know, everything's still very new, and so we're going to hopefully learn some things, but, you know, learn some things with, you know, the idea that this is all still new. But before we get started on any of that, let's go back, David, and talk a little bit about your running career, when you got started running, kind of where it took you, and how that went.
Sure, I can talk a little bit about that. I think I probably started my own running career. It was probably about 12, okay, in sixth grade, and I remember training for an 800 meter run that the school was having, and just kind of got hooked on the sport from there, and kept going, ran through junior high and high school competitively, both varsity cross country and track, and then ran in college, D3 at a small school in Appleton, Wisconsin, Lawrence University, cross country and track. And
where did you go to high school?
Green Bay East, okay. High school. Yeah, okay. Yep. So made it to state my senior year in track and field in the 2 mile run. Just, you know, kept plugging away at it, and had some successes along the way, certainly, both in college and in high school, and kept running through medical school, and still running today.
Yeah. Very cool. And what kinds of things have you done in the running realm since then, in terms of marathons, any ultras? I know you mentioned off air here, so you did some triathlons and that kind of thing as well.
Yeah, so I've kind of, anything endurance sport wise has kind of been of interest to me. Certainly in high school and college, focused primarily on the mile, 2 mile, 5K. Mm-hmm. And in medical school, ran my first couple of marathons, kept doing a lot of, you know, road races, 10Ks, 10 milers, did my first ultra coming up here in Duluth back in the early 2000s, and enjoyed those. Certainly enjoy the trails and the trail experience. It's been a delight to be using that resource that's just amazing here in town. I have done a couple of triathlons. Both were half Ironmans. I remember my first one was the, both were the Superior Man, Ironmans, or half Ironmans, and I remember being very nervous jumping into the water off the Vista Queen. Had never done any open water swimming as part
None.
Of my training. None. Zero.
None. Yep. Wow.
So I sort of was a little nervous and did jump in the water. Swim was not my best attribute that day, but the biking and the running were all fine. And came back and did another one and I really enjoyed the experience. I'm always looking to find creative ways to train and avoid injuries, and some cross training has been a good recipe for me. Mm-hmm. Nordic skiing, started that essentially when I moved up here, and I'll be doing my 20th Birkebeiner this February.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
My longest run, I did a 100-miler last November. Wow. In the midst of our Thanksgiving blizzard. two snowstorms. That was a great accomplishment, but it was an ordeal.
Yeah. What race was that?
It was my own. I was scheduled to do one in southern Wisconsin in early November, down in the Kettle Moraine Forest.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had a family commitment that conflicted with that at the last minute, so wow. I just decided I'd push it off. And the day after Thanksgiving, I started on my own, and it started snowing, and I just kept going.
What was your route or the course? Or
I did about three. I had three different routes that all brought me back to my house. Uh-huh. So they were through Hartley and through Bagley and through some of the streets on the east side of Duluth. Longest loop was about 7 or 8 miles, and the shortest was about 3 miles, and then I had a five and a half mile loop, and
wow. That's a lot.
So I could just
loops.
Keep coming back to yeah. the house, get more food, get stuff to drink, use the bathroom, sit down for a little bit if I needed to, and just
keep on going,
ground it out. Yeah. Took me about 30 plus hours to
yeah.
do it.
Wow. Yeah. Through the night and everything.
Yep.
You don't get a lot of daylight in late November.
No, it was. I would definitely not go that late in the year in this part of the world if I were to do it again. But it was much more about just sort of a personal drive to do that distance, and was really very felt very accomplished to get it done.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that is a great accomplishment. It's a solo 100-miler
yeah.
around town.
Yeah, I had a little help. My dog ran about 30 miles with me.
Wow.
She loved every minute of it. And my wife ran a couple loops with me, and my son and my daughter ran a couple loops with me.
Yeah.
So that was really pretty fun.
Yeah, I was gonna ask if anybody joined, if your family joined in. Yeah.
They did.
That's a great setup. If to set it up like that, they're able to do, like, I don't want to go for 30 miles with
yeah,
you, Dad,
nope,
but I'll go for three.
I'll go for three, exactly. Yeah, or I'll ride the bike with you while you run.
Yeah,
you know?
There's that
so
too.
Wow. That was good, actually. It was really, it was very meaningful.
That's really interesting, what you did as a solo 100-miler, because we're seeing so many of those virtual races. And
yeah.
People just this past weekend doing their solo Boston.
Absolutely.
And I've witnessed them both in person and kind of just through social media, found in a way that they're almost more special because it's unique to you. This is your race.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It is. It's just your own doing. You
yeah.
know, and it was, you know, I really found that I enjoyed it. And again, it was very personalized for me.
Yeah.
I did not. You know, it wasn't a sanctioned course, and so, you know, it's not an official, but in my book...
On your resume.
On my resume, it's absolutely there. Exactly, right. It
yeah.
counts.
100%.
And
yeah,
sure. So it was really a great experience.
It's like
yeah.
the original
right.
virtual race.
Exactly.
And
you're
the course record holder now, too.
Right. Absolutely. And no one will challenge that course because I'm never doing it again. So, yeah.
Wait, but I got to ask. I mean, you have the 100-mile finish stamped on your resume. Would you do that distance again?
You know, I don't know. That's an interesting question because right now at this stage of my career running-wise, I'm really sort of looking at what's next for me. You know, sort of what do I want to do? I've kind of done everything from, you know, short, fast stuff to really long, arduous stuff that takes, you know, a lot of training.
Plus hours.
I mean, you can't do a run like that without putting in, you know, hours and hours of training.
Right.
So I'm not sure. If given the opportunity and the right conditions and maybe you know, a special destination course to try, maybe, yeah.
Well, do you feel like the November race 100 in Kettle, like you want to go back and...
You know, that is not really, no, because, you know, I didn't, if I had done it, maybe, but that's a really small race. That's, it's probably in the 100 mile category, consistently finishers are maybe a dozen at most.
Right.
Yeah. And wow. And maybe 20 to 30 people start it.
Wow.
There's a 200 mile option as well, and uh-huh. I think that usually there's maybe 4 or 5 people that finish that.
Right, yeah.
There's a 50 miler, and you know, a modest number of people will do that. So, not terribly drawn to that. It was just, it was on the map, and it was, you know, going to be supported, and
sure.
And it was in an area that I have family in southern Wisconsin. So
right.
I thought, oh, this makes sense, but. I'm thinking maybe somewhere out west might be a little more to my liking. I'd love to do, you know, that's the thing. This sport has grown so much. You know, the Superior Trail Ultra is, I mean, it's a lottery system to get even an entry now.
Right.
You know, I mean,
right.
that's nuts.
Yeah.
And when I first came to town, it was like no one wanted to do that.
You
kind
just
of
drive
stuff.
Up and
yeah.
enter.
You just, exactly. You could enter the day of the race, show up and you were in, you know. So,
right.
But now if you don't get entered by January or February, you're probably not going to get a chance. So.
Yeah, it's crazy how that sport specifically has really taken off in the
yeah.
last, even just 5 years, but 10 years for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, so good question. Don't know.
I'm kind of curious, David. So you've done a lot of different running disciplines, from short, fast, to long, arduous. I'm kind of curious, going back to your college days or post-grad, you know, you were kind of maybe a long-distance specialist technically, right, in
mm-hmm.
the 2-mile, 5K?
Yep.
What spurred your transition out of college to running marathons? Or did you start with more 5K fast stuff? Or what was that transition like?
You know, I think I started with, you know, continuing to do 5Ks and 10Ks. And I think I kind of realized that I didn't have enough natural speed to get much faster than I was.
Yeah.
I mean, I was decent, but I wasn't going to get a whole lot quicker. I wasn't going to get into the, you know, mid 14s. Low 14s. I was going to be scraping by to get under 15. But so I just thought, well, maybe there's something else out there that, you know, I can get away with a slower sort of turnover, leg turnover, and just grind it out for more miles. And the marathon kind of became that. I started with a few halves and felt like those were really enjoyable. You know, just backing off on the pace a little bit, but going a little bit longer, and
right.
And so the marathon kind of became the next target. And you know, I had some decent successes early on, and so it just kind of kept me going.
Hmm.
Yep. So a little slower, but definitely a little longer.
Any specific successes that you can reminisce upon, or
I
mean, if you're talking in the sub 15 for a 5K, I mean,
yeah,
you
so
must
have
been racing in some elite
categories. So for the marathon, I got down to about a 2:28 for a personal best. Won the Madison Marathon my last year of medical school.
Cool.
So that was actually really just kind of a super great way to end my 4 years as a student there. I stayed on and did my residency there, but my family was there out on the course. I had trained really hard that spring, and just was in great shape. I'd run Crazy Legs. Do you know the Crazy Legs race?
Mm-hmm.
Which is from the state capitol down through State Street and up through Bascom Hill.
It used to be a big race.
It's a very big race.
It still is.
It's about 8,000-10,000 people.
What
in
distance
the,
is that again?
It's 8K.
8K,
yeah. So, and it's full of Badger, you know, so the Badger men and women, cross-country and track folks will run that race.
Yeah.
My fourth year of medical school, so just a month before the Madison Marathon, I was fourth in that race, fourth or fifth, in just over 25 minutes for the 8K. So I was really in good shape, and you know, felt like things will go well with this race, and they did. And you know, then residency came, and life gets halted the way you are used to it as a resident, particularly your first year is just, it's brutal.
Hmm.
Yeah. you're lucky to sleep. you're on call every third or fourth night, and you're just exhausted. And
yeah.
You just can't train. There's no way to train.
The routine.
Yeah, I mean, you just cannot develop a routine.
Right.
It's broken up with these incredibly busy call nights in which you're getting no sleep whatsoever.
Right.
And it's a grinder, you know. So
sure.
After that first year was over, I started to put some more training together. And by my last year of residency, I was back to running marathons and came up here and ran a marathon at Grandma's. You know, continued to do marathons for the first few years here, and then started looking at some of the longer stuff, and just really found the trail running scene to my liking.
Mm-hmm.
Got into the Northern Minnesota spring and fall series of trail races, and just enjoyed it. And and you know, I don't. Getting older, you just, you know.
Gravitate.
You're not as fast, man.
Right.
Things slow down, and so you just you have to make your peace with that, and find a way to continue to have a healthy approach to the sport, because you're not going to win all your races anymore. Or you're not going to place in the top 10 or the top 5.
25 minute AK.
Yep, you're not going to do a 25 minute AK at 40 years of age. It's humbling, but, you know, I think then it becomes really even more evident about the value of exercise just in a healthy lifestyle.
Sure.
To keep your body moving, to keep your joints moving, to keep your weight stable, to help with your mood, to help with a good sleep cycle. So all those benefits, and you still, you know, even without competing, you're still getting all of that. And so that's sort of, you know, been my focus is more now on just goals that are personal to me. Like,
right.
I want to run 100 miles. and it doesn't mean I have to do it in a sanctioned event. I'll just do it on my own. And,
right.
and I've run long enough to say that still counts and it's important. to me, so, yeah.
I got to know, okay, like even just being through medical school, how do you manage your time and train at a high level? I mean, I feel like so many people say, like, that's the easiest excuse for why you're not training well. I just don't have enough time. I'm too busy, you know?
Yeah, you know, that, it was interesting because the first year, maybe the first 2 years of medical school was this period of adjustment where you really had to figure out how to structure your days and how to be efficient and how to be organized and how to study when you needed to study and how to make time for other things that were really important to you.
Hmm.
The amount of free time drastically reduced compared to what I was used to in college or in high school. Absolutely.
Right.
But it was still possible to do it. Maybe I missed out on a few things, but the running was important enough to me at that point that, that I still wanted to dedicate the time that I had
sure.
to it. And, you know, the biggest challenge was when you were in the clinical third and fourth years of your medical school experience, because you'd change a clinical rotation every 2 to 6 weeks. And each time you did, it was a different schedule. So you had
right.
to figure out when were you going to do your training? When were you going to do your running? When was, you know, how was that going to work
yeah.
with the requirements of being in the hospital, being in the clinic, being on call.
Yeah.
But thankfully, it was doable, you know. Huh. And in my last year, I actually finished a little early. So I had sort of about a 6 week period of time where I could really focus on that last marathon, you know, that I did in Madison. And it worked out great.
Nice.
But yeah, it's a lot of trying to put structure and organization into your day and making time for what you value.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you have those specific priorities, it's a little easier.
It is. Yeah. I think when people are motivated to do things,
right.
yeah. the sky's the limit. You can do incredible things. But you know, if you're not really motivated or it isn't really resonating with you, then.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably going to be a struggle, right?
Right.
And that personal motivator, I think, in healthcare is really that is that magic thing that you as a physician can kind of help connect your patient to find that thing that really motivates them to change their health.
Sure.
And then support them and help advocate for them and watch them do great things. But it's figuring out how to get them motivated.
Right.
Not you motivating them.
Yeah.
They have to motivate themselves.
Yeah, sure,
you know,
yeah.
That personal stake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you can't just be like, look at me. I love running. You should love running, right?
No, right. Exactly. That's usually not going to work that well. But I think, you know, figuring out what is it that they want to change? What is it that they want to see different? And then what experiences have they had maybe that can be really helpful for them if they were an athlete earlier in their life and then
right.
they sort of let that go a little bit or they went away from that regular exercise routine, they're going to have that knowledge of what it took or what they can at least remember that experience
sure.
and say, okay, I'm not going to get there tomorrow, but I can get back to something like that.
Yeah.
And I, you know, what I do really try to focus on is just bringing up the benefit of a healthy lifestyle to people. Exercise is such an amazing determinant of health.
Right.
And if it's done regularly, it can just eliminate so many issues for people down the road. You know, the element of chronic disease is really about sort of it's about many things, but one of them is neglecting regular exercise.
Sure.
Yeah. And maybe not knowing how to do exercise. That's the other thing. I think if you haven't regularly exercised by the time you're late in your teenage years to early in your 20s, it's really difficult to establish those patterns when you're in your 30s or 40s or 50s because you just have never done it before. And so I think if we can get people doing things regularly in their youth, they're much more likely to keep going with it as they get older.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. I hadn't really considered it a lot, especially if someone is, say, in their 30s or so and trying to just introduce an active lifestyle.
Yep.
It's going to be a real challenge.
It's overwhelming in many ways.
And then there's going to be, I would imagine for a lot of them, just, I don't know, a sense of, I don't know if it's shame is too strong of a word, but the sense of, oh my gosh, I'm not very good at all. My other 30 or people that I know are really pretty good at this, and I am not. And that's a hard thing for adults just to have, regardless, whatever it is, learning a language or learning a guitar or whatever. That's really difficult for adults to.
Yeah, I think you really need to stress, you know, just that ability to be patient with yourself.
Yeah.
And to try not to compare yourself to others. I mean, that's hard. You know, we all do it, right?
Right, yeah.
And runners do that a lot. You know,
gosh.
Oh, what's your best time? You know, that's just part of the nature of the sport. So I think that's where, you know, I think I can offer some reinforcement of don't go down this rabbit hole because this is really not going to help you.
Right.
And you just have to try to focus on these things and follow up regularly with your patients and support their progress and recognize the things that they're doing and I just try to remind people that, you know, we're not going to build this in a day. You know, this is going to take some time, but the effort you make now is going to get you to a place that you really want to be.
Yeah,
that's pretty exciting.
I think it's really important to kind of offer that time frame idea of longer term than what we're so used to in modern living of kind of instant gratification and things happening quickly. And in a way, I always try to emphasize it. It's a beautiful thing to have a long-term goal in this day and age. And we have so few long-term goals, and it's kind of a nice thing to change your mindset and kind of gear shift a little bit down to something like that.
Yeah, I think the nature of endurance sports and those who do them really can understand sort of that, you know, that appeal to setting goals and knowing that, you know, there are steps along the way, but that it isn't going to happen tomorrow, you know, and so that's a mantra for me for my life. You know, I mean, I've lived a life of delayed gratification for for a long time, and it served me well.
It does, you know? It does. Yeah.
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 I think running is such a hard sport to get into for someone who's never done it too. I mean, first of all, it hurts really bad if you start.
Yeah.
And, you know, it, I think that's really the main thing. I mean, do you think, David, that running is a good sport for someone? Like, say they're in their 30s, they've never worked out, they've been video games, and now, you know, that's kind of the age where you start seeing the effects of, like, you got to do something.
Right, right, right. Yeah, exactly. So I would say, you know, the first thing that I tell my patients is, don't do something you hate just because somebody yes. says it's really good for you, right? I mean, the good thing is there are just literally dozens and dozens and dozens of activities that are really good for you.
Right.
And so choose something that you think you like or that you have some experience with and you remember really enjoying and liking. Huh. You got to be able to have some love for it. And I think running is, in my opinion, running is probably the most efficient way to get exercise. You yes. don't need a lot of equipment. You don't need yeah, a right. special place. You can just go out your door. You can do it indoors. You can, you know, if you've got some good shoes and maybe, you know, if you're running outdoors in Duluth in the winter, you know, some good clothing and things of that nature. Right. But there's so very little that you really need mm-hmm. to do this sport. So, and I like it because of just that raw efficiency.
Oh, yeah.
It's there. But I do warn my patients, you know, look, if you're starting running and this is the first go around, you know, in 20 years, mix walking and jogging first or light running and walking and really be sensible. We talk about how much mileage to think about increasing on a weekly basis to try to avoid injury. We talk about the importance of rest and recovery. And just establishing consistency first off, something that you're doing repeatedly. If you can do that over the course of about 3 to 4 weeks, you've now established a habit that you're more likely to then build on and,
right.
and really kind of, you know, even see some greater results from. But yeah, I mean, if you're just looking at, boy, what's the most efficient sport out there to do, it is probably running.
Yeah, right,
there's not much cleaner than that.
Yeah, I agree for sure. Well, let's talk a little bit, kind of speaking along those lines. You were mentioning, David, off air before we got started, some of your experiences overseas with running and studying endurance training and things. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, Tony, that was a great year of my life. I mean, honestly, if I think back to, you know, some of the events that have helped to shape me as a person and the direction I've sort of taken in my life, that year was one of them. So my senior year of college, I applied for a Watson Fellowship. A Watson Foundation was formed by Tom Watson, the founder of IBM.
Okay.
And so this program gives 75 year-long fellowships to students graduating from colleges in the United States, and they are all self-designed projects. So they are projects of your own passion, your own interest, and really, more often than not, they're designed to be done without a formal connection to a university. So you're not pursuing a master's degree or a PhD or anything like that. It's really a wanderjahr or a wander sort of exploring experience sort of centered around an area of passion for you. And that was long distance running for me. And so I looked at two areas of the world, the Scandinavian countries that had this great history of producing great distance runners and really had still a lot of passion in following the sport, particularly with cross country and track and field. Very knowledgeable fan base, really active participation in some of the major track and field meets, which occur in the summer. So Bislett Games and the Mobile Grand Prix series, which was in Helsinki and Stockholm also. And then looking at Kenya, which was currently at that time and still is, you know, producing some of the greatest long distance runners in the world. And my focus was not really on physiology or science, and that was kind of a departure for me because my background was biochemistry as an undergraduate, and I was going on to medical school after I got done with this study year.
And
so
what year is this taking place?
88 and 89.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
So the games had just ended in Seoul, South Korea.
Yep.
Peter Rono won the gold medal in the 1500 meters, and he was a graduate, recent graduate of St. Patrick's High School in Etain.
Yep.
Came back to the school to show everyone his gold medal and be honored by the school while I was there. So it was really a great, great experience. But that school is just, you know, it is the who's who of long distance running. At least at that time, it was. So I just sort of sent a letter off to Colm, brother Colm O'Connell, who was the headmaster of the school, and I said, you know, I'm doing this project. I really would like to live and train with your students and. I'll teach biology for you if you need me to do some work, and he welcomed me, and so I lived with the boys for the better part of the year, and got to know them really well, and train with them, and even competed in one race with them.
Nice.
It was just an amazing experience, and many of those young men ended up winning medals in the next couple of Olympics and World Cross Country Championships, and just the tradition continues.
I just watched recently a special on YouTube about David Rudisha.
Yeah,
and the school, and Brother Colm was kind of the main character, and Rudisha was almost the secondary character in that story. But one thing that I took away was that school is amazing. Just let the running stuff aside. The school is incredible what they do.
It's
impressive.
Yeah, the academic rigor of that school is truly amazing with, you know, very little resources.
And since 1976, I think he said he was there first.
I want to say that that's right. Yeah, and Brother Colm is, he's stepped away from the school.
Mm-hmm.
He's no longer the headmaster, but he was just a man of very, he's very honest and very humble. He knew nothing about athletics before he came to St. Patrick's and Etain.
Right.
Nothing. Yeah. But he said, you know, he could spot the talent. He could see that these were just incredibly gifted athletes. And I think more than anything was just a really strong, supportive force in their life. Was very giving of his time and his resources and his energies, and the athletes were amazingly appreciative and still come back to the school, you know, to visit as alumnus.
Yeah, it's really cool.
So wait, what was the project if it wasn't more physiology?
So the project was to look at sort of the cultural elements of long distance running, and at the time the majority of runners were all from sort of one geographical area, the northwest, sort of north and west of Nairobi, about 400 kilometers, kind of to the east of Lake Victoria, which straddles the border between Uganda and Kenya, up kind of in the highlands. So this area was, naturally... at altitude, about 8,000 feet, rural, very agrarian, very limited in terms of infrastructure and roads and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
And the predominant group that ran were the Nandi or Kalenjin, as they're also known, and their culture is very unique. That's sort of... part of their success is sort of their cultural traditions and cultural history really lends itself to long distance running. So learning about that and getting to know their families and making visits to their home villages, really, really interesting to figure out who they were as people.
Right.
And how that sort of intertwined with the sport of long distance running.
What elements of their culture do you think lends itself to
success? So I'll give you a real simple example. They have a belief, their creation story is that the Creator put them on Earth to herd all of the cattle. And so they would go on these journeys or raids to take cattle from other areas. And oftentimes this would involve traveling, running, and walking, mm-hmm. you know, 20, 30, 40 miles.
Sure.
And so a rite of passage to become a warrior in this group involved you being able to do, you know, some of these really, really arduous endurance events. And
overland.
Yeah, overland. Yep. And so that was, I mean, could you think of a sport that was more aligned with that sort of tradition? And so endurance and fortitude and longevity, all right. sort of these traits that were really highly valued.
Right.
That sport became this sort of natural funnel for them. It also became an incredible source of economic right. stability for their families.
Sure.
So they would, you know, go off to university in the United States and then
sure.
run on the road racing circuit and win races, send money back home that would buy crops and more livestock and land and... Mm. It was an incredible opportunity for them to further their families and to
right.
improve their lives.
Sure.
So, really, an interesting way to see a sport as part of who people are.
Yeah. And sometimes the debate between culture and genetics and what breeds success.
Yeah,
I'm always more on the culture side than the genetic side.
Yeah, for sure. So. I mean, I think, you know, you could look at that, you know, the length of their femurs relative to their tibias and the
right.
ratios of that. Is it optimal for the long distance stride for running and
right.
and their body mass index and their the fact that they, you know, have just incredible VO2s because they grew up at altitude and
yeah.
they have all these sort of physiological adaptations perhaps,
mm-hmm.
but I agree, I think their culture and the importance of that sport to them
yeah.
really is amazing.
Yeah.
Helps have both though, probably, huh?
I think, oh, yeah.
It helps have both and other factors as well, opportunities as well. Those people, you know, they
right.
existed before the opportunities arose
right.
to be able to go to the United States and then start to do these things. But
exactly.
Some of the cultural aspects that I kind of think about is, in fact, Scandinavia and the Finns, two different times, the Finns were the dominant culture in the running world
yep.
and over the course of like 30, 40 years. I mean, there's no genetic advantage there. They were really good, and then they weren't as good, and then they were really good again because their culture changed. And, you know, are Canadians genetically superior to play hockey? No, it's their culture. You
yeah.
know?
Yep.
That's what their passion is. So.
Yeah, I think in Scandinavia, it was very obvious to me that, you know, outdoor lifestyle was really important. People got out in the middle of winter. I would see families with infants. You know, walking around cities like Oslo, 10 below zero.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just absolutely considered to be normal, healthy to get out and take a walk.
Yeah.
And you'd see families riding the trains in the winter. They'd get off at the stop. They'd put their cross-country skis on, and everybody would start trekking off into the woods towards their cabin or their hütte.
Yeah.
And they were also, you know, really isolated from mountains
yeah.
and from the geography of many of the Scandinavian countries lent itself to just sort of this ability or need to locomote yourself, you
yeah.
know, to get places.
Key to be, yeah.
Yep.
So you mentioned that this year-long endeavor kind of shaped who you are now. What did you take away from that, or is there any way where you...
Yes, yeah. So, you know, you have to keep in mind for, and you won't know this, but, you know, I prior to doing this, I had never traveled anywhere.
Uh-huh.
I had never left the United States.
Mm.
I think the furthest away I'd been to, you know, was maybe Washington, D.C., and maybe Colorado. I was a pretty sheltered kid growing up in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and... And so this was just this amazing experience of learning resilience and learning flexibility and learning to be a stranger.
Sure.
And to be dependent on the kindness of others. People that had no reason to do anything nice for me. Right. None.
Yeah.
And they did.
Sure.
And so it was a really eye-opening event, you know, sort of in my own shaping of who I wanted to be as a person, and things that I still, you know, try to do in my daily life are founded in sort of that experience of, do you remember when, you know, this happened? And so it was a great experience. I think I learned more about myself than I learned about long distance running, but I think that's the whole point of the experience.
Right.
That's the point of the Watson is not to know or become an expert in your field of study or what you set out to learn. It's really to experience, you know, a growth in yourself.
Sure.
Yeah.
Cool.
So it was good.
Yeah. That's a really great opportunity and a really cool story. It's nice to hear, the ideas of these different cultures and stuff, especially
right.
just as a running perspective. That's super cool.
Yeah, I would love to go back to Etain. Yeah, I've seen documentaries more recently, and it's become this, you know, amazing training hub, and
right.
everyone goes, you know, from Europeans to Americans, and mm-hmm. you know, they spend time there. And when I was there, there was no one there. You know, I mean, it was just sort of this undiscovered, just beautiful place.
Yeah.
But I'd still love to go back, you know, and see the school again and see how it's changed and see if there are any people that I would remember.
Yeah.
You know, or would remember me.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, let's shift gears a little bit and let's talk about kind of the main topic of the conversation today, and a little bit about some of the COVID information and what you know runners need to potentially be concerned about, you know, what we need to keep an eye out for, and what are some of the effects.
Yeah, so this is I would couch our discussion today with the really important idea that, you know, we're 6 months into knowing anything about this virus.
Yeah, we almost have like a disclaimer bell or something.
Yeah, exactly. Right, right. Every time you think you've got something figured out about this virus, something new comes up, or something that, you know, you didn't think could happen with this virus happens. So it's, I think as long as we're all sort of, you know, keeping in mind that we're still really learning about what this is all about, I think that's the most important thing. Obviously, we're nowhere near being done with this pandemic. And I know people want to be done with it. You know, that I know we're all fatigued with physical distancing and remote learning and wearing masks and doing all the things that sort of have changed in our lives. But we're not done with it yet. And nowhere was that more evident than this summer, you know, after we did a really good job of locking down and you know, sort of everybody put in about 60 days to 90 days of some really good efforts, and we saw those numbers just go down and down and down and down, and then we started reopening things, and things got opened probably too quickly, and, you know, our case numbers went back up again, and we've seen some really devastating effects with that starting in mid-July,
mm-hmm.
A little bit later here in the Northland in St. Louis County, but by August, things were starting to pop here, and we've really seen some increased numbers even locally.
Yeah.
So we're not done. I think it is, it's also a little bit concerning coming into the fall, knowing that flu season's going to start relatively soon, and what that will mean to have, you know, potentially both COVID and influenza going at the same time. So if I can make a plug to get a flu shot, it would really be a good idea if you're, you know, thinking, I don't know if I want to get one this year. This is definitely the year to get one. It's going to help really keep influenza patients down in the hospital, and it'll make things much easier for clinicians to determine what somebody's dealing with. Mm-hmm. Even if you do get flu, it should be milder if you've gotten the vaccine. So I would encourage people to get their flu shot. Yeah.
Okay. One reason why I wanted to kind of talk about this on our podcast today is, you know, obviously for the distance runners and the concerns and talk of myocarditis and some of mm-hmm. that recent study that came out of Germany not long ago was really scary.
Yep.
And now a couple of things that I've read as just a layperson that maybe debunked that study a little bit. And this is a separate topic, but as a layperson, it's really difficult to know where the good information is. And I think that's another thing that we can talk about too. But let's talk a little bit about that and what we're seeing with some of the inflammations and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, Tony. So that's a really, it is a massively hot topic right now. And one of, I think, in general, there's never been a time in medicine where there's been as much debate about the validity of studies and the results of studies and the ability to trust the conclusions of studies.
Yeah.
Everything is happening so rapidly. Many of these studies may not be well designed. They may not be well controlled. I mean, we've run into just a nightmare situation with the studies that have looked at the role of convalescent plasma mm-hmm. in treating patients, you know, using plasma from patients who've already had the infection to treat somebody who's infected. So I think you're right. There may be a lot of sort of walking back of some of the original conclusions that some of these studies have come up with, and particularly the study out of Germany that looked at myocarditis. But I think we can be relatively, I mean, even if we're conservative, I think this virus has demonstrated that it's got a predilection to cause cardiac issues more so than other viruses that we typically deal with.
Yeah.
Much more so. And why that is, I don't know. I don't think anybody knows whether that is truly just the viral damage to the myocardium or whether it's the inflammatory response of the individual or whether it's both. So I think you're going to stay tuned or have to stay tuned for sort of the final call on that. But I think that's really true of a lot of the clinical sequela or outcomes that people can experience with this. We're just not sure why does somebody get such a bad case and somebody else doesn't.
Mm-hmm. What is the German study? Or I'm not familiar with myocarditis.
Yeah,
myocarditis.
Yeah, so it was a study looking at the effects of the virus on patients who had been infected and their hearts.
Uh-huh.
And it compared to, I believe it compared to age-matched controls who were not infected. Mm-hmm. And it found, you know, I don't even know if I'm remembering it correctly, but it found at least a 20% incidence of myocarditis changes. And I think, if I'm remembering this correctly, the study looked at MRI changes to these patients. So you're looking at changes that are not only scarring, but inflammation, swelling, and pretty dramatic numbers.
Hmm.
So I think, I don't know, again, if it'll end up to be that the data has been scrutinized and sort of even the authors have sort of backed down a little bit from and recognized that maybe their study wasn't done in necessarily the most scientific method or way. But it looks like this is something that we're not seeing with typical viruses. And so I can tell you for sure things like influenza and even just other coronaviruses, you know, and those are the viruses that cause colds, right? Same family as the SARS-CoV-2 virus. You know, that's probably about a 1% or less than 1%.
change in your
incidence
heart.
Or chance that you're going to get myocarditis after an infection.
What is myocarditis exactly? That's just
so myocarditis is basically an inflammation of the muscle of the heart, and it's usually due to an infection, and oftentimes can be linked to a viral infection. Can be linked to other things as well, but often some patients are going to recover in the matter of, you know, several weeks, and some people are going to have some very long-term complications. They're going to get scarring, and they're going to get impairment of the ability for that heart muscle to effectively squeeze or pump. And they're going to go into congestive heart failure. That's sort of the biggest risk long term is developing heart failure.
Now I was kind of interested, and this was several months ago, kind of right away, and I remember reading on the CDC website risk factors for a severe infection. You just mentioned, you know, there's so much question. There's so many questions out there of why does one person, you know, get a you know, bad illness, and one person doesn't have any symptoms at all, and maybe there's not a lot of correlations, I guess, but still the CDC you know, put out some risk factors, and I thought it was interesting, and you kind of touched on this earlier, David, in terms of, you know, people, the health aspect of running and how it's so efficient for just staying healthy, and the list of, you know, risk factors, they were all very preventative, like COPD and obesity, and I can't even remember them all, but heart failure, I think, or heart disease, and it's like, huh, how much of these, or what percent of COVID risk factors could be prevented by running every day?
Right.
Like, all of them, practically, not just running every day, but...
Yeah, I think you bring up a great point, and that is that you're right. Many of the risk factors and obesity, diabetes uncontrolled, particularly hypertension, cardiovascular disease, chronic lung disease. And then the other one that's really not under anyone's control is age. And the older you are, the likelihood is far greater that the outcome is going to be worse. And that is very clear and evident in Minnesota and really every state. About 70% of our deaths are in people that are over the age of 70 years old. And many of those lived in long-term care facilities, nursing homes and assisted living and things of that nature. And early on in the evolution of this pandemic, particularly in Minnesota, this was a really, really major issue. We had to figure out how to keep our patients in these facilities safe. So we started with eliminating visitors. Family and other friends could not come into the facility because oftentimes they were bringing the infection with them.
Right.
And then staff, the people that worked in these facilities, were coming in and they were infected, maybe asymptomatic, they might have been younger, and they were infecting and exposing the residents, and the residents were getting ill and having, you know, really horrible outcomes, oftentimes death. So the state has done a really good job of recognizing that and of creating infection control programs that work. And we've seen the numbers, you know, go down.
Right.
But if you want to look at the demographic of our society that has been most affected, it's somebody over the age of 70. It's also very evident that access to healthcare is really a determinant to who's not going to do well with this as well. And so African-American populations and Latino populations who may not have access to good health care have much higher death rates and complications and poor outcomes as a result of that. And they may have many more chronic health problems that are tied to that really poor access to good quality health care as well. So if anything, this pandemic has sort of, in my estimation, it's really exposed a lot of the weaknesses of our healthcare system, mm-hmm. and a lot of the areas in which we just have these terrible gaps in which we're not serving everyone, and our access is not as good.
Right.
And so these are areas that I think we need to make some really thoughtful changes long term. And I'm not confident at this point that we've recognized all of those things that we need to do to change.
Right.
I think all of us just simply want that short term, we want this over with, and then we'll forget about it. We can't forget about it, because I'll tell you, this will not be the last infectious pandemic. There will be something else that comes. It may not be, it may be coronavirus that keeps recirculating just as influenza does every year, but there'll be something new. There will absolutely be another one. Will it come in 5 years or 10 years? I don't know. But look, the history tells us that it's going to happen. SARS and MERS and now COVID and influenza, and the number of pandemics that we've had with influenza alone. So we should not be under the illusion that this is it. You know, once we're done with it, we're in the clear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just like the messaging and the news, it's all just like the vaccine is getting closer and closer. But is it just like because our culture and society is that instant gratification, not the delayed gratification? So the messaging of, hey, maybe if you look out and try and prevent some of these, you know, preventable illnesses, age being the one exception perhaps.
Right.
But, I mean, here's a way to avoid getting into a long-term care facility. One way is to have a healthier life from age 30 on, right?
Absolutely.
I'm not a doctor, but I would say.
No, absolutely. These are things, again, that are just, I think, have been really exposed as vulnerabilities and weaknesses and gaps in our healthcare system. But you're right. You know, many of these things are preventable illnesses, you know, and much of chronic disease is. It's tied to lifestyle and years of not healthy lifestyle.
So as like endurance athletes and the people listening to the podcast today, how much would you say they should have concern versus confidence in their fitness and everything?
Well, I think, you know, I'll answer that question with a couple of just simple pieces of advice.
Uh-huh.
One, you know, if COVID isn't gone, then shape your behavior to reflect that reality.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see, you know, any event that's going to occur, such as, you know, the Twin Cities Marathon. It's not going to occur in a traditional sense this fall. It shouldn't, it can't, and it's just too much of a risk. So I think you want to be cautious and careful with your training. You know, if you're going to run with a group, be really confident about what that group is doing to maintain their safety and to limit their exposure to the virus. I have no concerns about using the trails and coming across somebody running the other way. Really, honestly, the greatest dangers are the 6 foot 15 minute rule. You know, if you're within 6 feet and longer than 15 minutes, not with some sort of protection, that's a risk. But running and passing somebody on a trail there's very little risk, and I think people should be confident to continue to do that. It's really the group dynamics of running and how many people do you train with, what's your training group. Be cautious with that still. Make that reasonable. So that's the first thing. The second is, if you're ill and you are suspicious that you may have COVID, then get tested. Please do get tested. And right now, Minnesota's indications, the Minnesota Department of Health's indications for testing are to test anyone who is symptomatic, Anyone who's been exposed to a known COVID case can also get tested whether they're symptomatic or not. And we really want people to do that. If you come back, if you have symptoms of COVID or you come back with a COVID positive test, it's really important to back off on your exercise and the intensity of your exercise.
Okay.
In fact, I probably would not do much more than just, you know, some very light jogging or walking until you are over and clear of your symptoms. If you have been diagnosed with myocarditis, it's probably really important to, and you're going to see a cardiologist or a specialist and they're going to reinforce this, but it's probably really important not to do any significant exertional activity for about 3 to 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then, you know, under the care of your physician or your healthcare provider, you know, be gradually working back up to, you know, more intense exercise as tolerated if you're given that green light or given that okay.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've got that diagnosis particularly, be really cautious. You're just going to have to put things on hold for a little while because the risk of more damage to the muscle and more scarring to the heart is probably going to outweigh any benefit you're going to get from that vigorous or intense physical exercise.
Okay. Yeah, very good.
What if, okay, this is just a totally fake scenario, but what if my friend, my best training partner, likes to throw parties and go to the bar,
yep,
and engage in high-risk activities,
yep,
but we still run every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, hey, you know, I don't want to expose myself, so we should run side by side, 6 feet apart, or you go behind me on the trail, I'll go in front.
Yeah.
Or you go in front and I'll go behind, or the air is moving by, no risk. I mean, what is there a particular, you know, we don't want to stop running with our running group and stuff, is there a more or less risky?
Yeah, so of those scenarios you gave me, certainly the 6 foot separation side by side, absolutely fine. I would not have any qualms about that. If you were going to run one person in front of the other, I'd be in front of that person so that they're inhaling my slipstream rather than I'm inhaling their slipstream.
Sure.
And this gets to, you know, this bigger issue of sort of how is this virus transmitted? And there's really three methods, sort of fomite transmission. I have COVID, my nose is running, I'm sneezing, I sneeze into my hand and I wipe it on the table, and then 5 minutes later, you put your hand on that table and then touch your face, your mucous membranes, your eyes, your nose, your mouth, and you become infected. That's a pretty limited capacity for transmission for this particular virus. It can happen, don't get me wrong, but it's not huge.
Right.
And really, the key is wash your hands a lot, don't touch your face if you can avoid it. And then wipe down commonly touched surfaces, you know. So those are easy things to do.
Mm-hmm.
Droplet transmission is by far sort of where the majority of transmission with COVID is occurring. And that's, if I sneeze or cough, droplets come out of my mouth. If I don't have a mask on, if I'm not covering my, you know, cough into my arm, these droplets, which are pretty good sized, are going to end up traveling. And in most studies, they travel about 3 to 4 feet.
Mm.
But sometimes they can travel a little bit further. So that's
the
sort of
wind blows. Or...
Yeah, right. I mean, so that's sort of the recommendation of 6 feet. You know, people say, why 6 feet? Because most droplets, 3 to 4 to 5 feet, they're going to be then down on the ground.
Mm.
Even if the person didn't cover their mouth, didn't cover their cough, didn't cover their sneeze, whatever it is.
Right.
The last method is aerosols, and these are these really tiny, like 5 micrometer particles that have virus in them, along with maybe a little bit of respiratory fluid, and these can float in the air.
Right.
And this is what terrifies people about, you know, transmission is, you know, am I going to breathe in the air of somebody that, you know, is sick and was in this space 30 minutes ago, and I'm going to get sick.
Right.
And the answer to that is maybe, but not too likely. It is absolutely a way in which this virus can be transmitted, but again, droplets and being within 6 feet of somebody who is sneezing, coughing, is by far the greatest risk in terms of this. Hmm. People talk about sort of your airstream that you generate when you're cycling or you're running, and you get that respiratory rate up there, and, uh-huh. and air's moving in and out, and are these little aerosol droplets moving in and out. Yeah, but outside, they're going to be fairly easily dispersed,
right.
And the concentration immediately is going to be diminished. Hmm. In a closed room, maybe a little bit more concentration, and maybe a little bit more important to let that room sit for a little while. So if you're, for instance, you know, getting to get on the treadmill after somebody's been on there and they were cranking out a workout in which they ran 3x5 minute miles, right. You know, I'd probably wait a little while if I wasn't sure who that person was before I got on that treadmill, and I'd let that room air out a little bit.
Huffing and puffing.
But outdoors, it's safer, you know, not without risk. And then again, I think that's one of the things that people sometimes let their guard down with, particularly is, oh, I'm outside, I don't have to worry about that physical distancing or staying 6 feet away because we're outside. Yeah, you do, actually. It helps to be outside, but it really helps to stay 6 feet, and it really helps to have that mask in those situations where you can't maintain that 6 foot distance, particularly. Even if it's outdoors or indoors, it doesn't matter.
Right.
So if it were me, I might run with my buddy, but I'd be 6 feet away from him or her. I might ask them just sort of about sort of, you know, what's been the behavior, you know, what have you been doing, who you've been with, have you been out to the bars, that
it's
type
like
of
bar.
Stuff.
Yeah.
And bars are just, they have been at the epicenter of this rise in cases in Minnesota since about mid-July. Yeah. Many, 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 many cases have been linked to going to bars. Yeah.
Nope. Luckily, there's not a huge crossover with the running group crowd and the bar crowd.
Yeah, you know, maybe not. Although some folks, I know they enjoy that element of training hard
and
working, you know, and celebrating, you know.
Oh, okay.
But I think, I find Dr. Fauci to be just an incredibly interesting human being, and you know, he's just so knowledgeable. He's just really humble, and he's a delight to listen to. You know, I've had an opportunity to look at a lot of interviews that he's done over the last several months, and he just keeps doing them. You know, he's really available. But one of the things that he's really pretty adamant about is, you know, look, I'm just not going to go out to a restaurant or a bar anytime soon. There's just too much association with cases in that environment, and in many ways I think that's one of the areas that we sort of opened up too soon in Minnesota. And I know I understand the economic impact of businesses. Oh my gosh, you know, it's just been horrible for everybody that owns businesses and that particularly owns restaurants and bars. But I just don't think that we were safe enough with what we did and how we did it. And we've seen the cases to prove it.
My last question on the topic that I have anyways is races.
Yeah.
So races, I think racing is inherently a high-risk activity just because it's a mass group of people. But just like we've talked about, you know, being outside and if we can be 6 feet apart, what do you think the future is for races? Do you think the current guidelines, like with what Grandma's Marathon has done with the Fickers 5K that just this past weekend, do you think that's too strict, not strict enough? You know, where do you stand on races in general?
That's a great question, and I think I'm not dodging the question, but I think what will be really interesting is to see what happens in a couple of weeks. If there is an uptick in cases associated with that event is possible. I know that they were pretty meticulous. I know they were very meticulous. I know that they had really good consultation with the medical staff at Essentia, and you know, their medical director Ben Nelson, you know, was involved in all of the elements of sort of planning and running this type of an event. But I think the proof is going to be sort of, we have these estimates about what we think is safe, and then you run an event and you find out maybe it wasn't. Maybe it wasn't safe enough. And the only way that we're going to find that out is to look at the number of cases that occur and whether there's a connection to that event. And if there's a connection there, then I think it's good to modify and change moving forward.
Right.
I think it's going to be a while before we're back to 5,000 people towing the starting line of a race, whether that's, you know, a marathon or a 5K.
Or Berkey.
Or Berkey. Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's going to be maybe another 6 months to a year before we see anything that's sort of like what we're used to. But I think, you know, humans are adaptable and resilient, and they change, right? I mean, we have the capacity to change, and I've seen so many amazing things that are reflections of people figuring ways out to do things, even still connecting socially with others and still being safe.
Yeah.
And so I think we'll figure it out with respect to things like, you know, racing and make it happen, you know. But I think right now it's sort of, we're not exactly sure what's safe enough.
Right.
And so we make our best guesses and I think, you know, try to do the right thing, and I applaud grandmas for what they've done. They've put safety first, but we'll find out just, you know, how effective was the plan in a few weeks' time.
All right. Well, one last question for me. What's next on your running agenda?
So that is a really good question, Tony, and I've been kind of struggling with trying to figure out what do I want to do next. Where does my passion lie for sort of the next event or the next kind of endeavor? And I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I know I'm going to do my 20th Berkey, and then I may take a break from Berkeys.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay.
You know, that feels okay to me. I'm not going to stop skiing. I really enjoy it, and it's a great way to make winter go by quicker, and we have just beautiful places to ski, and so I'll keep skiing. But I think, you know, I might do the Prince Haakon or the Cordy for a few years and just sort of take it a little bit easier with respect to the Berkey. I've toyed around with the idea of trying to run the mile, going back.
Right.
Yep.
And a couple years ago, I was 50 and was, you know, was training for a fast mile and did really well, but it was incredibly hard.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you just don't realize how speed is lost as you get older. Your leg turnover, I mean, it's just...
like the effort feels the same, and you look at the numbers and...
Oh my gosh, you're like, what?
I'm running just as hard
I
as
am
I
running,
used to.
This, no way can this be a 80-minute quarter mile, you know, or 80-second quarter mile. It's got to be a 65, you know? And you're like, nope, the watch doesn't lie. The watch never lies. That's the beauty of running. So I think, I don't know, remains to be seen, but I think I'm okay with having a little bit of uncertainty. You know, I mean, right now that's what we're all dealing with, is uncertainty with respect to COVID and sort of what's our life going to look like you know, next week or the next month. Yeah. We don't really know, right? Yeah.
Here's an idea for you, David. Last year, Tony and I were talking about, and I don't think anyone actually did it, but there was the back-to-back. There's two back-to-back races, and this was actually last weekend last year. It was the Minnesota Mile, mm-hmm. your mile,
yep.
and then Sawtooth the next day.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think anyone did it. We might have to look at the results.
Yeah, but I don't think so.
That's the back-to-back.
That would be an unusual combination, you know, taking two very different skill sets and putting them right together in one weekend, right?
Yep. Better that way than the 100-mile than a 1-mile.
Right, I think exactly. You'd want to run the mile first, for sure. Yeah,
you're going 100 back down to
yep,
the 1.
Exactly, yep. I would agree, but we'll see. We'll see.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, David. That was a really fun conversation, really good information on some of the COVID stuff, and fun to hear about some of your travels and running experiences as well.
Well, thanks. It was a pleasure to be with both of you. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks
again.
You bet. All right. And that takes care of episode number 26 of the Duluth Rundown. I want to thank again our sponsors, Austin Jarl. Also a big thank you to Dr. David Worley, who came down and talked to us about a lot of really cool things and, you know, some really good information about COVID and, you know, some potential concerns for runners and that kind of a thing too. Super happy to have him on the podcast for that. And thanks, Mike, for doing all the work that you do. Mike's our editing guy, so he kind of puts it all together after we do our recording process. So, yeah.
Well, thanks to our listeners, and keep the good ideas coming.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
And hopefully everyone can get out and go for a run in the near future.
Yeah, we'll see you out there.